This is Sean Lynn Jones. I'm editor of the Quarterly Journal International Security, which is based at the Belfer Center at the Harvard Kennedy School. Today I'll be talking to Dr. Lucas Kello, who has written a fascinating article in the fall 2013 issue of International Security. The article's called The Meaning of the Cyber Revolution: Perils to Theory and Statecraft, and it looks at some of the questions regarding cybersecurity that have been particularly prominent in international relations in the last few years. Dr. Kello is a joint postdoctoral research fellow in the International Security Program and the Project on Technology, Security, and Conflict in the Cyber Age at the Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center. He's got a bachelor's degree from Harvard College and earned his master's and doctorate in international relations at Oxford University. His doctoral work looked at the origins of post-war European integration in the 1940s and 50s, and he taught courses there on international relations, security studies, the Cold War, and the politics of the European Union. Now, at Harvard, he designs and teaches courses for postgraduate students on international cybersecurity, and he's writing a book on the impact of the cyber revolution on international relations that builds on his article in International Security. It's good to have you with us today, Lucas. Thanks for coming by. I'd like to ask you first how you became interested in this topic, because just looking at your biography, it's clear that you entered international relations and studied some topics that are quite different than the cyber revolution and cybersecurity. So how did you get from there to here?
That's correct, Sean. Computer technology was indeed very primitive in the 1940s and 50s. So what aroused my interest in the topic were the cyber attacks against Estonia's financial and government computer systems in the spring of 2007. Until then, the ability of cyber instruments to cause national-scale economic and social disruption was still very much a theoretical proposition only. These attacks changed that. So cyber conflict suddenly became a proven and, importantly for the research community, observable phenomenon in international affairs. And of course, mine was not the only interest aroused. This event inserted the cyber issue firmly and, I would say, irrevocably into the international relations and security agenda. Most notably, it prompted the NATO member states to establish in 2008 a center of excellence on cyber defense.
When we talk about cyber and cybersecurity, I'm not a technologist, and I'm sometimes not sure exactly what it means. So maybe it would help if you could just define some of the basic terms here. I mean, what exactly is cyber war or a cyber attack or any other of the key terms that we use when we talk about this phenomenon?
Your question hits at an important point, which is that we don't yet have clear or agreed upon concepts to frame the cyber issue, at least from a security studies perspective. Use of the term cyber war in particular is an example of this problem. It is grossly misused to characterize a wide range of actions, even if they have no physical effects. So here's a proposition. If a hostile cyber action produces no loss of life or physical destruction of property comparable to a conventional military strike, then the label of cyber war should not be applied to describe it. The term should be used only sparingly.
What exactly is the difference between, you know, cyber warfare and just computer hacking to steal information, you know, espionage, if you will, or just crime to steal information that might be useful for business purposes or for something else? I don't quite understand when it becomes a warfare and when it's just a criminal activity.
That's another very important conceptual question. And to begin to answer it, I think it's important to understand why it is misguided to think of a cyber attack that does not meet the traditional criterion of war as either crime or espionage. First, it can be very difficult to punish a cyber attack in domestic courts if the perpetrator, as is often the case, resides abroad. Second, the notion of cyber espionage applies only to those actions that involve the theft of an adversary's military or industrial secrets. In other words, by definition, it does not involve disruptive or destructive intent. Lastly, it's important, I think, to note that the distinction between cyber espionage and cyber attacks itself is important, because each form of action invites different legal and policy consequences. Espionage is not prohibited by international law, whereas an offensive cyber attack could in principle be construed as a use of force, or even indeed an armed attack under international treaty obligations.
Okay, so what are the real elements of the cyber threat that we, meaning the United States or the world in general or individuals, are facing today? I see a lot of press reports that say that some government official has said that a cyber Pearl Harbor is going to happen any day now. But is that really likely? And what actually has happened in any cyber attacks we've seen, including the ones you mentioned in Estonia?
So invocation of the Pearl Harbor attack as an analogy to capture the contemporary cyber threat is misguided. The new weapons are unlikely to produce the scale of destruction and death witnessed in 1941. But I understand why this term has been used by decision makers such as Leon Panetta. Parallels of this sort raise awareness of the gravity of the cyber danger in a society that is still, I would claim, largely asleep to it. The reality, however, is that the vast majority of cyber attacks, so far at least, do not contain a destructive element. Rather, what we observe is the use of cyber weapons to disrupt economic and social activity, as was witnessed in the attacks against Estonia. Although that is changing, as illustrated by the Stuxnet incident, which destroyed hundreds of nuclear enrichment centrifuges in Iran.
Now, there are a lot of people, at least some, who say the whole notion of the cyber threat is exaggerated. And indeed, in answering my last question, you implied that maybe there is a little bit of exaggeration, maybe hype, on the part of government officials to make sure that this issue gets attention. But there are some skeptics out there who would go a little bit farther and say that this threat isn't so significant, and there really haven't been any catastrophic attacks. And if it really were a big threat, we would have seen something already. How do you respond to people who make this sort of skeptical argument?
So there are two ways, I would say, to answer this question. One is according to the opinions of those very security planners that you noted, who are tasked with defense against the threat. If these practitioners are correct, and their views are indeed unequivocal about the scale of the threat, then the threat to national security is, in fact, enormous. The U.S. intelligence community, for example, recently rated the cyber threat higher than global terrorism. Yet much of the substance for these kinds of assessments derives from classified information, which makes such claims unverifiable by researchers. But based on the record of observable events, and that is the second means to answer this question, it's clear that the upper threshold of offensive action in this domain is rising. Before the Stuxnet event, for example, which became known in 2010, use of cyber weapons to destroy physical facilities abroad was only a theoretical proposition, and it's now a proven outcome, much as the ability to paralyze the economic life of an entire nation was proven by the Estonia case. So what we see then is that the bounds of the possible of offensive action is steadily pushing upwards. And insofar as the claims of decision makers are concerned, I think we do need to concede that these are individuals who have privileged access to information on the reality of the threat.
Well, I realize that you may not have that kind of access to classified information, but could you say a little bit more, just from your own perspective, what sort of cyber attack, potential cyber attack, keeps you up at night, makes you really worried that something catastrophic could happen?
Well, I would say that my understanding of the state of the possible is that a catastrophic attack might indeed be possible. And there are various simulations of such attack that have been conducted by the government and by private industry that suggest that. But what keeps me up at night at the moment is not necessarily a catastrophic attack, but rather a more lower or mid-range attack that might not produce a calamitous loss of life or physical destruction of property, but that may nevertheless disrupt our economy or our way of life.
In your article, you make the claim right in the title that there has been a cyber revolution, and this is going to have some pretty important implications. Obviously, one of these implications might be the greater level of danger from cyber attacks, but you seem to think there's more to it than that, and this is something, well, maybe not quite as major as the nuclear revolution, but a big change in the way international politics has been conducted. So I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about what's revolutionary about the cyber revolution, and how is cyber warfare changing the international system, or how will it change the international system, and how will it affect who does what to whom in world politics?
The answer depends on the criterion we apply to conceptualize a revolution in international relations. Military and strategic thinkers sometimes describe the current cyber age as a revolution in military affairs because, in their view, the related technology significantly alters the methods and character of war fighting. But from a scholarly international relations perspective, the notion of revolution, I think, has a more fundamental meaning, and it has to do more with changes in what scholars refer to as the state of war, that is, the regularized patterns of competition and violence among states coexisting in anarchical society, than the means of war per se. So the conceptual bar, for us at least, is higher. But even on the criterion set by political theory, we can see that cyber activity is having a limited but still observable impact on patterns of international competition. And perhaps the most important is the dispersion of power away from governments in the cyber domain. While states remain the principal actors, they're not alone. And non-traditional players such as private organized groups and even individuals can cause astonishing effects. And we saw that again with the cyber attacks on Estonia and Georgia, and we will probably witness it again. And this trend in particular, which is quite unique to the cyber domain, challenges the state-centric mold in which dominant IR theories, at least, are cast.
When it comes to cyber war, is it easier to attack or to defend?
It is far easier to attack than to defend. And not only against actions that would rise to the level of cyber war, but I would argue that it is the offense holds the advantage generally in this domain. And I would enumerate at least four major factors that complicate defense against cyber attack. One is the number of weaknesses in computer systems that an attacker can manipulate, which is very large and indeed theoretically limitless. Mostly these weaknesses are unknown to the defender, which is why they are called by the technical community zero or O days. Consequently, it's very difficult to predict the precise method of attack, which complicates the design of measures to repulse it. Second, the most advanced players in this domain are able to insert themselves into the adversaries of computer systems, into adversaries' computer systems without detection, as occurred in the Stuxnet case. this gives them opportunities to override defensive acts, possibly in real time. Third, the defensive side itself is highly fragmented. The majority of critical infrastructures in this, as in other countries, are owned and operated by private industry, which raises significant obstacles to coordination when responding to a cyber emergency. And lastly, computer systems increasingly rely on off-the-shelf and offshore manufacturers for software and hardware components, which introduces vulnerabilities into the supply chain. Just to give one example, in 2009, Britain's Joint Intelligence Committee warned that components of BT's phone network obtained from China could be preloaded with malware, giving Beijing the ability to interrupt the country's power and food supplies, potentially. So these and other factors make cyberspace very much an offense superior domain.
Well, that thought, as well as your occasional references to the Stuxnet operations, makes me wonder what all of this means for the United States. And maybe we could begin by focusing on those Stuxnet attacks, because the initial press coverage basically was that the United States had carried off a very successful cyber operation that helped undermine Iran's nuclear program. But then there have been a lot of other accounts saying that its impact was greatly exaggerated, and it only really set back the Iranian nuclear program by a matter of months, perhaps. So this is really a fascinating case study, to the extent we know something about it, that may show how the United States can use this operation to serve its national interests, as well as perhaps the limits of a cyber attack when another country becomes aware, or the target country becomes aware and reacts. So could you say a little bit more about exactly what happened and what the real meaning of the whole Stuxnet operation is, indeed, if we know?
So this particular operation remains shrouded in government secrecy.
What exactly happened?
So the Iranians know.
What do we know?
The Iranians are the ones who know best what happened, but they're unlikely to reveal it. What we can do in the research community is extrapolate from one IAEA report, which suggests that the operation impaired up to 1,000 IR-1 uranium enrichment centrifuges at the Natanz nuclear facility in 2009.
And how did it do that exactly? I know if there was a virus involved or something, malware.
It was, in fact, a worm. Which destroyed centrifuges by manipulating the Siemens-built industrial controller to which they were coupled.
And so that made it much harder for Iran to enrich uranium that could be used.
Well, that's a more difficult question to answer. Okay. But some analysts in the U.S. government and elsewhere have suggested that the overall effects of this operation could have been to delay uranium enrichment towards a bomb by up to 2 or 3 years. And certainly the immediate direct physical effects of the operation could not have produced such a delay. But I think the argument here is that there were psychological effects to the operation. For example, the fear that Iran's adversaries may have been inserted into computer systems elsewhere in the country's nuclear establishment, which sowed discord more generally in that country's nuclear program.
Are there other examples that we know of successful U.S. cyber operations? Or is it just Stuxnet that is the example of what we've been able to accomplish, even though it's debated?
I think this is the clearest case we have that points to involvement by Washington. But even here, it's difficult to draw that connection conclusively. And the reason for that is that the connection is based on largely on interviews of public officials in this country who spoke under cover of anonymity. But I think on the basis of deduction, we can argue with a strong degree of certainty that at least the United States and Israel as well were involved in this operation.
Going beyond the particular case of Stuxnet, what do you think the cyber revolution is going to mean for the United States? You know, on the one hand, I can see an argument that, as in other areas of high technology, when it comes to cyber warfare, the United States is going to have a big advantage because it will be the master of how to, you know, design and implement quite devious cyber attacks such as the Stuxnet operation. On the other, maybe there are some American vulnerabilities that could lead other countries to be able to launch successful operations against the United States. On balance, what do you think this means for America?
The answer to this question is mixed. On the one hand, the United States is indeed one of the most capable, if not the most capable, offensive players in the cyber domain. And it has the capability to design, assemble, and deliver a sophisticated destructive artifact like Stuxnet. On the other hand, because of its reliance on computer systems for essential economic and social functions, this country is also especially vulnerable to cyber attacks. It is comparatively far more difficult, for instance, to find feasible targets for cyber attack in, say, North Korea, where computer infrastructures remain very primitive. So I think therein lies one of the central paradoxes of the cyber revolution, which is that societies that are most adept at harnessing the gains of cyberspace are also those most exposed to its hazards. Technological and industrial strength are becoming synonymous with vulnerability.
Well, that leads to the question of what is to be done. In your article, you offer a lot of thoughts about how the community of scholars who study international relations and particularly international security questions has yet to really engage with the cyber revolution. You know, it's a little bit surprising since it's been in the news so much. But why haven't we seen more scholarly attention to these topics? It certainly seems like there's some need for new thinking and maybe even some policy advice to major powers like the United States. Where's the academic community?
So I would say, as a general observation, that the scholarly community, at least within the field of security studies, is in a state of technological sleep. And the reason for that is that although a few notable scholarly studies of the cyber issue do exist, the issue has largely been neglected by thinkers in our field, and this is reflected in the scant relevant literature. And I think there are two basic reasons for this general state of neglect. First, I suspect that our preconceptions as a field turn us away from an evaluation of the cyber issue. There is a tendency, at least in some quarters, to think that threats which appear to lack an overtly physical character or that don't rise to the level of traditional interstate violence are simply intellectually uninteresting. But second, and this is the more fundamental reason, there is a sense that methodological obstacles prohibit orderly investigation of the issue.
Well, that's what I was thinking too. How can you study something when it's hardly happened at all? You don't have any cases to look at. You know, won't the academic study of cyber warfare accelerate as soon as we get a little bit more cyber warfare?
Well, insofar as we consider catastrophic or high-impact destructive cyber attacks, then I think your observation, I mean, it's correct. We don't have many instances to examine. There's on the destructive end, there we really only have Stuxnet, and on the more catastrophic end, we don't have any such instances. But let's look at other technological domains of conflict. The nuclear revolution, for example. We have only two data points, both in the same war, occurring in 1945. And yet that did not prevent a tremendous amount of theories about nuclear conflict and nuclear strategy from emerging. So I think that is a good indicator of how we as a scholarly community can assess the cyber issue in the absence of significant cases, at least on the catastrophic side, to examine. That said, the number of cases that involve non-destructive but still disruptive attacks is quite high.
Can scholars study this issue if they don't really have the background in computer science, information technology? Isn't this always going to be restricted to the people who really understand not only how to write the code but to insert, you know, malware, worm, or otherwise into an adversary's computer network?
Too often, the presumption is no. We, as laypersons, technical laypersons, cannot examine the cyber issue because a high level of technical knowledge is required to do that. This creates a sense of resignation, which is suggesting that the cyber issue lies beyond the ability of scholars in our field to comprehend it. I would claim, however, that cyber studies does not require a miracle of technical learning, and what we need is just a minimum degree of technical expertise, which reveals to us what the scope of action in the cyber domain is. And importantly, we should not confuse technical expertise with strategic insight, because technical knowledge can reveal the scientific properties of a cyber artifact, but we still have to understand the social, political, ideological purposes for which it is used. Therefore, what cyber studies requires is a congress of disciplines that includes certainly the engineering sciences, but also the political and social sciences.
Well, assuming we can get the academic community mobilized to do more research on cybersecurity, what should their agenda be? What areas really need attention? And I guess even more importantly, if we were to make progress in understanding the whole question of cybersecurity, would it really make a difference in the real world, or would it just be, you know, more scholars debating one another in isolation? So what should we do and why, I guess, is what it boils down to.
There's an expanding range of theoretical and policy-oriented questions which security scholars can immediately begin to address. Theory-wise, at the most basic level, we should begin to reflect on how the cyber revolution affects our fundamental theoretical concepts like anarchy, order, and system. Given its potentially destabilizing effects on strategic stability and international order. Second, scholars must open up their conceptual toolkits to do what they traditionally do, which is to model, explain, and insofar as is possible, predict adversarial cyber relationships. And this may involve the application of existing theoretical paradigms, such as the balance of power or institutional theory, Or it could be more narrowly focused, accounting for a specific incidents. For example, an analysis of the regional consequences of the cyber attacks against Iran. And finally, and I think this point needs stressing, because of the enormity of the challenges of the cyber, which the cyber revolution presents for security policy, scholars can guide the design of policy to affect cyber interactions. The pressures of decision making leave practitioners very little time for a strategic interpretation of rapid technological change. And as Robert Bowie once commented, they are under pressure to take action, some action, even before the implications of new technologies have been mastered. And this elevates the need for policy sciences within cyber studies. And if I were to lay stress on a particular issue of policy relevance for study, I would perhaps choose the notion of deterrence, which in the cyber domain remains primitive but is still an important area for policy if we look at strategy documents.
Based on your own work on cybersecurity so far, what is the single most important piece of advice that you would give U.S. policymakers on this issue? Or if there are two, that's fine as well. But is there a short message that policymakers need to hear from the academic community or from you in particular?
I would give one message, which is that there is a tendency in the public perception and in the perceptions of policymakers to frame the cyber issue and cyber attacks within the criterion, the Clausewitzian criterion of interstate violence. And I think this misses the essence of the contemporary cyber danger. It's true that the effects of the cyber revolution on the military equation is an important concern and should be examined. But it's not necessarily the correct framework to apply in understanding this issue. What we see is that the cyber revolution is expanding the range of strategic options and possible outcomes between the traditional concepts of war and peace. So I think it's that middle space of action that both strategic theory and policy needs to focus on.
Well, I think that's a very important point to end on, since it looks like we're just about out of time. Again, I've been talking to Lucas Kello, who's the author of an article in the fall issue of International Security called The Meaning of the Cyber Revolution, Perils to Theory and Statecraft. I have a feeling this topic's going to be with us for a while, and this is just one of many important contributions that you and perhaps other scholars as well will be making. So thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you, Sean.
Thanks for listening to this podcast, which was brought to you by International Security. For more information about the journal, or to subscribe at a special listeners-only 20% discount, visit mitpressjournals.org/IS and enter the discount code ISECKELLO, that's ISECKELLO, at checkout.